Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this episode number 83 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, today I'll be brief. This episode is one of those, in inverted commas, it does what it says on the tin episodes. I'm speaking, of course, to Sven Lorenz again. He co-runs the Sark Property Company, and as the title of the episode suggests, they have some quite exciting news about their investment plans and the general future of Sark. Anyway, I caught up with Sven in London a couple of weeks ago, but I've been holding back this episode until a major Sunday Times article on the same subject had published its exclusive a few days ago. Here, of course, you'll get to go much deeper into the announcement than a regular newspaper can. We discuss the Sark Property Company's upcoming cash bid for the Sark estate, which is currently owned by the Barclay family. And this episode should be of interest to you if you're a Sarkie or an incomer to Sark, or indeed just Sark curious, as I know many of you are. No need to explain too much here, just go ahead and listen to the show. I think we cover most things, and if we don't, well, you know how to get in contact with me, podcast@free-cities.org. I'm all ears, don't be shy. And if you want to go deeper into the world of places like Sark, well, we have a Telegram group, or if the digital world is not enough for you, then make sure you get yourself to Prague in November for our conference, Liberty in Our Lifetime. All the prominent projects will be there sharing their news, including Sark. And did you know, I'll just look to the website, it's only 132 days away. Before you know it, it'll be right on top of us. Anyway, everything you need to know is in the show notes, everything I've described in this intro, including contacting Sven or anyone else connected with the Sark project. And then, of course, my final words to you, as I'm sure you will know by now, will be to please sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Sven Lorenz. Spoke 8 months ago. That time I got a bit of an overview of Sark history, past, present, and future. I think today I'd like to talk about the future of Sark, and I think you've got some quite major things that have happened since I last spoke to you. And the plans, your plans in particular for Sark, have moved on a huge amount and are becoming quite real by the looks of it now. And In a number of days, you've got quite a big announcement that's going out that will be in the Times newspaper. There'll be an article explaining it all. So why don't you, this isn't going to come out before the article, we're not allowed, but why don't you explain what is going to be revealed in this article, and then we'll go a little bit deeper into it here.
So there will be an article or a feature in the Sunday Times, which is the best-selling UK Sunday newspaper, outlining to some extent that we have a plan, a fairly imminent plan, to place a cash bid for the Sark real estate portfolio currently held by the Barclay family, or members, or maybe one member of the Barclay family. That real estate portfolio makes up 20% of the land mass of the surface area of Sark, and a slightly bigger percentage of the built real estate of the island. So if this goes ahead, and this is the first time that a newspaper is going to write it quite like that, and with certain things that have happened over the last couple of months, this could become quite real quite fast. We are now at a potentially exciting new era for Sark, which will center around investment and bringing fresh energy to an island that really desperately needs fresh energy, in my view.
So this bid, is the money already there for the bid, or is this bid Is it part of generating money to fund the bid, let's say?
I quote my anchor investor who says that capital is really not going to be the issue for this one. So I run a licensed financial services company. We're a fund manager. We're allowed to handle other people's money. And that's why we're also very aware of the legal implications and the technicalities of such a process. And for the public, that usually makes no sense. I always get the question, you know, do you have the money in the bank? To which my answer would be, I'm not even allowed to have that money in the bank. And I can tell you like in half an hour why that's the case. The bottom line is that funding for this transaction is not going to be an issue. We've been cultivating and speaking to over 80 high net worth investors and family offices over the last 3 years who are interested in this. Many of them have approached us. We have in place an anchor investor who's a public figure, and that will be out soon. So funding for this is not the issue. The issue has been and will remain for a little while longer that it's a very complex transaction and set in a very difficult environment. And that's why this has all taken so long and why I, you know, talk about this for hours and can go into great details.
Can we go a little bit into great details? What are the complications of something like this? Normally when the money's there, the transaction's there, in my experience. What are the problems here?
Well, first of all, we spent 2.5 years investigating whether we actually really want to do this. So this was purely an internal problem or challenge, so to speak. You need to keep in mind that Sark is a tiny island. It's only got 600 residents right now. It's, as I always say, 2.5 times the size of Monaco in terms of land mass, which is about 1.5 times, I believe, the size of Central Park in New York. So it's tiny. And that means that a real estate transaction of this nature also isn't going to be very big in terms of money when you look at other real estate transactions. I always joke, and this is actually sort of half serious, that buying this portfolio is the equivalent of buying one building in London in Mayfair. And at the same time, you are, for example, taking on an extraordinary amount of responsibility and visibility also, because by being potentially the largest landowner in a jurisdiction, you will have all sorts of issues come your way, such as you're being probably going to be held responsible for this, that, and the other in terms of, you know, infrastructure needs to be fixed. So you're taking on much more than just buying a portfolio of real estate. And it has a political dimension to it as well. There's the whole history and, I dare say, you know, somewhat toxic legacy of the existing owners. There's no other more polite way of putting it. All of which we're stepping into, and we have spent 2.5 years, you know, considering from all perspectives, is this something we want to do? If we do it, what does it imply? What do we need to do to make sure that some of the negative things that have happened to the current owners, that they don't happen to us as well? So, you know, you see where I'm coming with this. This is not just something you decide like, I'm going to buy a house. This is a major decision that will be followed by a 1 or 2 generation investment program. None of this is going to happen overnight, and we wanted to consider everything very carefully.
So it's you're all in, basically, if it goes ahead, is what you're saying.
Literally, also in terms of reputation. So this is going to be, if we do it, the highest profile thing I've done in my life. And I've done a few other things that were reasonably high profile already. But if this doesn't work out, you know, this has significant implications for me reputationally as well. We've considered that very carefully. And the same is true for the other directors of the company and everyone else who's backing our effort. We have a lot of first-class partners in terms of service providers who are working with us, all of which are in Guernsey, in the Channel Islands, or on Sark. And they're all going to be exposed as well. So, you know, this is not as I said, not an easy exercise to pull off.
Sometimes I like to know the answer to the question, not what's happening, but what isn't going to happen. Can you answer that?
Yes. So we're partnered with a real estate firm that just last week told me, you know, there's this misconception that Sark is for sale. And it's just a portfolio of real estate on Sark, but it's such a high profile portfolio and such a significant percentage of the overall land mass of the place, that somehow this idea has always been, you know, I don't know, going around partially in media as well, or at least in people's heads, that the island is for sale. And what we're not intending to do is take over the island or do everything on the island. We're in the first instance just buying a lot of individual real estate, and we have to fix that up. That's as simple as that.
Right. So it's a simple real estate deal, but presumably it does have very far-reaching implications. And behind it, the drive is to affect Sark in a major way, in some, according to your plan. So what is that? What is the plan? If you zoom out, the plan, not just the real estate deal.
So I think there are two key layers to it. First of all, a lot of that real estate is really run down. A lot of it is dormant or just simply almost like in ruins, and you can't use it right away. We want to fix that and reopen some of the hotels that have been closed, put some of the residential real estate that currently is not inhabited by anyone, put that back into circulation, make sure that we help with the housing shortage in Sark, which is just like everywhere else. There's not enough residential real estate space. The main shopping street of Sark, which is the first thing that any tourist in Sark sees when they arrive, is in really incredibly bad condition. Someone who visited recently, who knows something about this, told me that, you know, the word shantytown comes to mind. And we want to make sure that Sark gets a bit of a boost economically and financially, and also in terms of sentiment. There's a lot of negativity, and the island has been in a difficult economic situation for more years than I can remember now. Demographics on the island are problematic. There are the average age is way above 50, and that's after an influx of young people, so it used to be even worse. And an island that cannot keep its young and cannot attract families to live there and build their lives obviously is going to run into problems of some kind or another before too long. And we feel that by targeted and significant and well-planned investment into the real estate that's there, you are helping with that while also creating a very good investment case for the real estate. So that's really step one. Step two is we believe that once there is new dynamism and a sense of optimism and a bit of a can-do attitude, more things will be happening in Sark and more will be possible. What exactly that is remains to be discussed, but I think that's in a way also what makes this so exciting. Fixing up the existing real estate is really just the base case and step one.
And what about the infrastructure then? Is that something that you're concerned with? You're not buying infrastructure, just properties, is that right?
So to some extent we do, and infrastructure is an interesting subject, although it's possibly less of a subject than one would think. So Sark famously has no cars, so we have no paved roads. There is a harbour. The harbour is owned and operated by the government. And in a way there is nothing you need to, you know, it's not like there's major infrastructure needed to get started. There are issues. And one of them is the electricity and power generating infrastructure of the island, which is owned and operated by a private company owned by one person who lives in Guernsey. It's a very political and difficult subject. What's been happening with this electricity company would go too far now, but the building that this electricity company operates in, that is contained in that leasehold, in that portfolio. And it's a leasehold property, the lease for which will expire in 6 years. So in 6 years, the electricity company is facing the issue of they're losing the building unless they sign a contract to extend the leasehold, which is something that needs to be discussed with the landlord, which might then be us if we succeed in buying it. And there is, first of all, a very complex commercial issue behind an ailing and possibly soon failing electricity and power generation infrastructure on the island. You have contamination issues quite potentially. I don't know for sure, but what one hears on the island, there will be contamination issues. And that thing might fall into our lap, so to speak. So yes, we have infrastructure issues, but they are maybe not what is immediately visible, and they're not, as always, it's complex.
What's the general feeling amongst the locals about this plan? I mean, I'm imagining myself as a local. I live in the deep countryside, so I know what it's like when someone comes in, especially if they're buying up property. It's relatively scary. You don't know what's going on. What's the general feeling amongst local people? And like, do you even know? Like, is it a place where you can get together and discuss all this stuff?
So I think there are two key points worth mentioning. One is that when you ask around, there is an overwhelming sense of something has to happen. Sark has been stuck in a very difficult situation politically and economically for a long time. And that real estate portfolio and the conflict with the Barclay family, which from my perspective is, you know, in the past, but that very much played a role in there. The other aspect is, of course, that there is a worry, oh, are we going to live through the same thing again? And we have, from the very first step, always said we're going to ensure everything we humanly can to make sure that we make clear, no, it's not going to be a repeat of the past. And secondly, you know, we are investing our own lives into this as well, our time. We could all spend our time on different things. We don't want to create a difficult situation for ourselves that only means that we continue this nightmare, but then also become responsible for it. And we have communicated probably in a more transparent way than anyone in Sark has ever communicated about their plans. What you will get, like in any other jurisdiction or in any other place, there will always be a few people who are more outspoken than others. Many people don't want to speak to the media. So when the media turns up, you probably will find the same characters commenting over and over and over again. That may not lead to a representative image of what the population thinks, but it's very hard to define. And there are 600 people living on the island, and I guess you have 600 different viewpoints.
Can you really briefly just sum up the situation with the Barclays and what happened in the past? You said it's in the past, but they obviously own a large amount of 20% of the property on the island. Did they have a plan? It sounds like they had a plan previously that didn't seem to work out.
Yes, and it's complex to summarize it, but I'll give it my very best shot. And of course, it's going to be a subjective description. But they first bought the neighboring island to Sark in the 1990s, Brekku. Then built a castle there, and they tried to declare independence from Sark. Their viewpoint was that Brekku was never part of Sark, so they would have effectively controlled their own jurisdiction. That was not permitted by the authorities, and then instead they started to buy up the main island of Sark to have some kind of economic control over it.
Can I just stop you there? Authorities as in UK government or Sark government?
So it actually went to the Privy Council, as far as I know, and I wasn't around that much at the time, so I'm not a great person to speak about the details. But ultimately, the Channel Islands being a crown dependency, the ultimate power lies with the crown, which basically nowadays means the so-called Privy Council, which is the advisory council of the king, or at the time, the queen. And after they were told you can't do that, they bought up lots of property on Sark, and people would probably say they tried to dominate it economically and politically. They didn't succeed in getting their own people voted into parliament in Sark. And then various conflicts unfolded over the economic future and their investments in Sark. And it culminated with, in I think it was 2015, they fired everyone overnight, and they were the largest employer on the island by then. And they made the entire operation dormant, closed all the hotels, closed various other facilities. And that obviously had enormous ramification on the island, combined with they published a weekly newspaper, which was seen as very divisive and very hostile and toxic, which probably was, I think objectively that's true. And that divided the island into them and us. And it also stifled economic development and led to what I would describe as a downward spiral that's not really been stopped since then.
I see. That explains. So what's the major risk then here of failure?
Well, I mean, first of all, we are now speaking at a point where I haven't even put in a cash bid yet, never mind the fact that, you know, it may not get accepted. I mean, there's always, you know, first there's a negotiation. All of this is months away from happening, if it happens. There is a small remaining risk, although I would say it's only 10%, that, you know, sometime during the next couple of weeks we say, oh, you know what, we just leave the whole thing. It's just too much work, too much effort, da-di-da-di-da. I think the main risk really is execution. Let's assume our cash bid is accepted, the deal is taken to completion, we own this stuff from, say, 1st of January next year. Then we have to make serious investments into reconstituting the entire portfolio and fixing these things. That will involve major capital, it will involve staff, equipment and materials being brought to Sark, while at the same time operating some of these facilities. And all of that at a time when, for example, tourism in the Channel Islands is struggling because it costs £400 return to fly to Guernsey at some times. For that money, you can fly to somewhere where you've actually got guaranteed sunshine and where the coffee and food and hotels are a lot cheaper than the Channel Islands. So this place has so many challenges that, you know, just execution of a very basic business plan is a major risk.
You're a resident, though. I can't imagine you. One of your outcomes there was we might just realize it's too much hassle and too difficult. As a resident, I suspect that won't happen. Everyone I speak to from Sark has a real soft spot for Sark, and I think everyone there wants it to do well. I know there's a lot of people that live there just want to live a quiet life, but it seems like there's a lot of space for everyone. But those people that are engaged really want it to work. And it sounds like you said it's been stifled for some time for whatever reason. And I don't think anyone wants to see it stifled, put it that way. You were saying last time we spoke, even the shop is in danger of closing. Is that right?
Yes. And there are two great assets that give me great reason for optimism. One is that everyone loves Sark and people want to help and they want it to work, as you said. And this extends to, first of all, residents. And secondly, it also extends to service providers and partners further afield. For example, in Guernsey, we have an enormous amount of support from Guernsey because people in Guernsey say, we love Sark. We go there on holiday. I spent my childhood there, da, da, da. You know, let us know how we can help to make this succeed. And the other thing is, you can make a negative or pessimistic case that everything in Sark is very difficult. You can just as well make the opposite case and say this place is so easy to get anything done in because everything is within walking distance and the decision makers are usually your neighbors or, you know, they live a couple of streets down the road. And decision making is fairly quick in the sense that Sark has kept this culture of things are relatively simple, most things in any case, including, you know, permitting of refurbishing and new construction, all that sort of stuff. And there is no reason why with, I'd say, a diligent effort and good communication and a good faith effort to bring as many people along for the journey as possible. You're never going to convince everyone. Why we shouldn't be able to succeed with this and possibly even surpass expectations. But having said that, you can only do that if you live there and if you've lived there for a while, because you need to know how the place works. And like everywhere, there's a lot of local peculiarities.
What would you say then are the biggest opportunities that you can see for, well, let's say for Sark people, but also for everyone, anyone else, anyone who's nothing to do with Sark, but suddenly hears about this thing. What are the main opportunities that you see?
So for people who already live there, Sark has a few glaring problems: lack of housing, lack of affordable housing, lack of quality housing, lack of professional career opportunities for younger people. And generally, lack of income opportunities. In winter, for example, we've got this incredibly short tourism season, which is effectively from, if you're generous, from April to September. And really, it's just the summer months. And in winter, there's very little to do. And a lot of people are struggling to make ends meet in winter. And there's also on a governmental level, just like everywhere else, pressure on public finances. With, for example, population getting older, and even though there is no welfare system, things do fall into the lap of the government in terms of liabilities when someone is, you know, for example, has certain illnesses that they can't pay for when it comes to treatment. So a major investor could certainly help with all of these factors. And a conversation needs to be had about how do you combine commercial investment with doing something that's good for the entire existing community. And that's a conversation that property developers have all over the place. And none of this is, you know, new or different from anywhere else. In terms of people who are not there yet, so I get a constant stream of inquiries from people who want to move to Sark. It's a place that just somehow seems to generate interest, rightly or wrongly, but there's no shortage of people who would like to live there. Sark needs more economically active people. It probably needs more people overall because it just doesn't have critical mass right now. And none of that is going to happen unless there is more housing available. And that starts with fixing up what's already there. Sark could have a lot more people living there if you just fix up what's already in place. You don't need to add a single building. And unless a major investor comes in and makes that happen, it just won't. It's just stuck.
And as far as the sort of development of the island economically, is it, it's going to be tourism, according to you? This is your prediction, would you say? Or are there other ideas floating around?
I think in the past, up until 5 years ago, it would have always been tourism that everyone would have mentioned. I think since the pandemic, what has changed is obviously work from home and generally people being more mobile and better connected. Sark has incredibly good internet connectivity, thanks to being next to Guernsey. It's certainly faster than in London. We've got 4G, we've got Starlink. There's no reason why people shouldn't move to Sark and run a business from there. And that's increasingly what's been happening in the last couple of years. So do I have the definitive answer, or do I claim to know precisely what Sark's economy will look like in the future? I certainly don't. I'd say the number of options have broadened in the last couple of years, also driven by Guernsey being very successful economically, basically primarily on the back of its finance industry. There are now the first financial services employees who work in Guernsey but live in Sark and work remotely. So it's changing, and tourism is not the only answer.
And how does the governance model fit in with that? Because you've got a very unique governance model there. Presumably, that could be used to the advantage of a certain industry, say, or a certain type of work.
That could certainly be done, and in a way that's what the Channel Islands have done historically. So Jersey and Guernsey are obviously very strong in the financial sector in different areas. Alderney, the sort of lower profile Channel Island, has carved out a niche for itself in online gambling, which I would never suggest for Sark, but they've done that. I'd say you don't even need to think as far as, you know, creating or attracting any kind of business sector by way of introducing legislation. I think very simply, Sark has a, call it a governance model or a way of life, I would say, that is very attractive for people to live in. For a start, we don't have political parties. There's no government debt. There's no overbearing government. There's no, you know, Big Brother style intrusion into your life. Everything is very humane and very simple and how it used to be, starting with the fact that whilst the media is always obsessed about, this is a tax haven and people pay no taxes. Actually, I think what's the most attractive about Sark is that you have no obligation to keep a record of your income or your assets. It's entirely up to you what you keep a record of. And that summarizes a very sort of laissez-faire and humane and soft approach of government. There's no, you know, what government does in Sark is stuff for the people rather than, you know, people having to live their lives and waste their time on government. And that is, I think, the unique attractiveness of Sark and really the asset that helps it to attract this interest that it generates, besides its natural beauty and aspects such as, you know, it's car free, which I think is one of the greatest assets that Sark has, and I hope and I'm convinced it will always remain like that.
So you're not hell bent on innovating. It's not one of those places that's going to be trying to do something innovative. It's almost trying to work with what it's got that it does well. That is ironically quite unique now. Government does stick its nose in your business almost everywhere else, and it has the advantage, of course, that it's part of the United Kingdom.
Absolutely, but there is nothing that I think it needs to change on a major scale in the short term. Where all this goes longer term is a separate conversation. And something we've discussed with the authorities is Sark has no company register, and there's a whole number of reasons for that. There's one company register promoting itself on the web, which is not officially recognized by anyone. And it could make sense for Sark residents to have their own company register because it costs a lot of money to register companies elsewhere. And that's a burden on residents. that could be done. Is that a short-term priority for us? Not at all. We're just having exploratory conversations, and it's not really part of our business plan to push into this, that, or the other direction. In the first instance, it's a very basic, and I'm afraid, almost slightly dull real estate investment case, and everything else will flow from there.
How does it actually work? Who owns the majority of the land? Does it come with the properties, or is there a majority landowner, or does the government, you know?
So it's almost all privately owned, and historically in 1565 the island was divided between 40 landowners, and that changed a little bit. There are now, technically speaking, probably 90 pieces of land, and in 2020 a property reform was put into place. Land can now be subdivided, which wasn't the case until 2020, and it's effectively all in private hands, with the exception of a few government buildings, but it's minute. And yeah, all the land is in private hands.
And the properties that you're planning on buying, do they come with large parcels of land? Or are we talking houses on a small plot?
Yes. So the portfolio we're looking at is effectively 80 residential houses, 20 commercial properties, 5 hotels, although it's actually only 4 because one burnt down, and 140 acres or 150 acres of land.
And as far as building new houses, what's the process?
So right now, it's effectively not possible, in the sense that if you've lived on Sark for 15 years, then you can, under certain circumstances, build a house in a place where no house previously stood. You could buy a patch of, you know, field and put a house there if you get permission. But that barely, it does happen, but hardly ever, and it's not really worth spending much time on. Right now, it's all about using the existing real estate on the island. What Sark decides further down the road, in terms of, for example, introducing zoning, which doesn't exist yet, is a completely separate discussion, and one that the people of Sark, the residents, and the government need to have. We would love to have a long-term planning process underway on the island. That's something that we have been supporting, and already once paid for a workshop to be done with the existing population to establish what's the baseline of what people think and want. But again, that's years into the future and is not going to happen anytime soon. And until then, no one really knows for sure.
And of these buildings, you mentioned 80 residential. How many of them have tenants, and how many of them are derelict? And you said one of the hotels burnt down. What's the kind of state of this building portfolio?
So when you speak of tenants, you have to distinguish between two groups on Sark. So on Sark, the whole freehold and leasehold system is very strong and prevalent. So of the 80 properties, about 50 have been given away on the basis of long-term leasehold. So there will be people who possess these buildings for a period of, it's usually somewhere between 15 years remaining on the lease and sometimes up to 70 or 80 years. Three of them are like 250 years. So these are long-term leaseholds. And then there are buildings that are rented out in the conventional sense on an annual rental contract with a monthly or annual rent. And that's about, off the top of my head, 15 or 20. And then you've got a whole bunch of derelict ones. They're also, and it's a bit difficult at times to count what exactly we're dealing with. Because, for example, there is one property in the portfolio that's the foundation of an apartment building that was permitted in 2008. The foundation was built and then nothing else. So how do you count that? And even if you finish the building, you can divide it into few apartments or many apartments. God knows. It's all very complicated, is what I'm saying.
What about the, you said 5 hotels, right? Are they well-used hotels?
So these hotels were all closed until about 2020 or 21, from 2015, when the family that owns it right now said we're shutting everything.
Just to clarify as well, according to what people think, the reason they shut them all down is kind of like a power move, a bit vindictive.
Absolutely.
Okay, right.
Two of them are currently open and operating. Are they operating effectively? I think that's up for debate. There's a third one that's at least derelict, and whether it can be reopened and fixed remains to be seen. We have some concerns there. There's one that is so old that you really need to just tear it down and replace it. And the fifth one has burnt down and there's nothing left you.
And those that were reopened, was that a negotiation? Was that a goodwill gesture? How did that happen?
There was certainly a period when there was the Ice Age was visibly coming to an end. And these were, in a way, both goodwill gestures as well as commercial decisions, because that stuff doesn't get any better if you just leave it sitting there. This was also during the time of the late Sir David Barclay, who passed away in, I believe, 21. I'm sort of with a pandemic, you lose track of which years things happened in. Since then, a lot has changed. And because it's now a different generation as well, and it's also much in the past, and because quite a number of these people who were actively involved in that conflict have also died because old age, and as I said, demographics on Sark. So Sark has to a good extent moved on, but the real estate still sits there. So you could now say that maybe this conflict is more a thing of the past, but the physical manifestation of it is more visible and more present than ever, because these buildings, a good number of them, are falling apart.
And you're the first group that's had a go at this, is that right? Sort of, has anyone else attempted in the past to sort of get the island going again?
So we started looking at this and investigating it at a time when no one believed that this estate would ever be for sale. And we were called crazy at the time. In a way, in retrospective, this gave us a head start, because we've just spent 3 years analyzing this and putting together a plan and service providers and partners and collaborators. It's been offered discreetly for, I'd say, 2 years by now. It was never really made public that it was offered, so it was all a bit of a stealth process. And I doubt that there were many, potentially there were none, who were interested in the entire portfolio. There will always be people interested in individual bits of the portfolio. And I saw one well-known British hotel entrepreneur looking at one of these hotels. I live next to the hotel, so I see things. the value of living locally. But I have my doubts. So I'm obviously biased, and I'm in a way probably, I have zero credibility when I say that. But having spoken to someone in the real estate industry who knows a lot about this, they told me they just cannot imagine any scenario under which anyone from the outside would be interested in this portfolio, because it's too small, too screwed up, and the whole situation is too complex.
I think you certainly need to have some kind of skin in the game. I think it would be the worst place for an outsider to come in and try and do their thing. I think it has to be driven from within, certainly. I know you're a de facto outsider. Are you a Sarki? Are you classed as a Sarki yet?
By way of my accent, I would like to claim I'm an outsider who happens to live in Sark. I'm only renting, so,
I think we talked about how you become a Sarki last time. Isn't there a certain amount of time you need to spend on the island?
So I have a good friend on the island who's been there for over 50 years, and he says he isn't a local yet. So, locals are always the people who... outsiders are always the people who've been in a place one day less than you. Everyone defines themselves as local. Which is not even that term means nothing and has no, it's usually just used to project some kind of privilege, which doesn't exist. It's either resident or not resident. I'm a resident. It's my only home. I live there. I've been there full time since 2017.
Do you happen to know what the mix of Sarkis and incomers is?
Yes, we had a census last year or the year before, and it, not unsurprisingly for me, but surprisingly for everyone else, who looks at it from the outside, 70% of the population, 70, are not from Sark originally. So, that tells you everything you need to know.
It does. How likely do you think this is to go ahead then.
It's my baseline expectation. I'm having that discussion regularly with my girlfriend because, you know, we miss certain things on the island. We love it there, and we miss things such as having a gym, for example. So we have a gym at home, but it's just not the same thing as having a gym to go to with proper facilities. And there's always the temptation to say, oh, you know, shouldn't we live elsewhere? The last summer was grim. Weather is not always great. So there are many reasons to consider, you know, is this the best option? But we always come back to the baseline expectation in my house is that this will happen in some shape or form at some point. So am I delusional? Am I biased? Possibly to some extent, maybe, you know, otherwise I wouldn't tackle this. But right now I'm working on the assumption that in some shape or form, this will happen at some point.
And what's the, how does this relate to, for example, your neighbor Guernsey? And the UK, I mean, have you, do you get to, or do you need to speak to the UK government about any of this? Or is that something that's not none of their business?
So we try to be in touch with as many stakeholders as possible. And whereas Guernsey doesn't in any way have power over SAARC, SAARC is self-governing. Guernsey is obviously its neighbor, and there's a very close relationship by way of being in the same geographical area, the Channel Islands, and having this many centuries of a relationship with the UK and with the Crown. And the Seigneur of SAARC, who is the contractual counterpart to the English Crown, he is a director of the company I set up. So, you know, we tick that box. He, in turn, has close relationships with the Lieutenant Governor in Guernsey, who is the direct representative of the Crown, so right now the King in Guernsey. So we have that communication channel very open. We have put something in front of the Crown in terms of our plans as well. We certainly would be very happy to speak to the UK government, but that's covered through the Crown, the Privy Council. And we have had various discussions with members of the government of SAARC. Not every member of the government of SAARC wants to speak to us, but those that are happy to speak to us, we've spoken to, and we keep an open door to speak to anyone.
That's an interesting. I forgot about that. I assumed the government of SAARC would be behind this plan. Everyone, is that not the case?
No, and it's actually quite healthy that you can't make such a broad statement that the government is backing it, because I think having some people opposing your plans is always very healthy in terms of keeping you on your toes and making sure that you're extra careful with what you put in place. And just like anywhere, if you propose something that is a significant investment or potentially a major change, there will be people opposing you for any number of reasons that I'm not going to spell them out, but people have their personal motives.
But are there any hurdles to this plan via local government? I mean, so, it's a real estate deal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. So I come from the financial services industry, and I know a little bit about fundraising and mobilizing capital for something. And I have said from the absolute get-go 3 years ago that whatever plan we come up with has to stand on its own feet without the government having to approve it. So do we need to file planning permission for, you know, refurbishing or changing and investing into this real estate? Of course we do. There is a development control committee, and for anything that you change that is visible from the outside, you need to file for a permit. We will, and that's a good thing, and we will file for the necessary permits. Do we need for any laws to be changed or for the government to issue any kind of approval to this? No, we don't. And if that were the case, frankly, we wouldn't even be looking at it, because then, you know, you just don't have an investment case.
Just out of interest, what would be an example of a reason to be against this if you were in the government?
Worry, for example, that we have some kind of dark secret plan to change the island forever and build skyscrapers and erect factories that belch smoke into the atmosphere and change SAARC forever.
Okay, it's that fear of change, you think. Is that the most common? I mean, I know that from where I live, and I think it's a very real thing. I even have that. You know, if you hear banging on the other side of the valley and something going on, you wonder, oh my God, what's going to appear there? You
know? Absolutely. And I mean, I share that fear because I live in SAARC for a reason. And for a number of reasons, like everyone. And one of them is it's a great place to live because you're surrounded by nature and you have no cars. And it's a small community where people know each other. And we have said from the get-go that what we're proposing to do is aimed at protecting what makes Sark unique. To make Sark fit for the future, which right now it isn't, you need to change some things. But a discussion needs to be had what should be changed and what needs to be changed and what should be protected even further. And given the history of the island and this political conflict, I can totally and immediately understand that, yes, people would be worried. And instead of having that discussion, might just say, let's not change anything. And then there's always people benefiting, personally from certain situations and, who wants to give up his financially privileged, situation or access to something. So there's a multitude of factors. And I think that's a healthy thing. And that's just something you have to deal with in any place.
You may well have to prove your innocence, not have the guilt proven, if you know what I mean. I think you come with a quite dark legacy by the sounds of it. Not you personally, but the legacy of what has happened. And someone has come before you and obviously created quite a rift in the island. And
absolutely. And this is again why I think no one else will touch this. Because who wants to walk into that situation?
Oh, I don't know. Sounds quite fun to me. I like a challenge.
We would welcome other bidders. It would be very good for the price finding mechanism, because if there's several offers, then the owners will see what does the market ascribe in terms of value. That would actually be a healthy thing. So one of the reasons why I'm actually quite public about this is because I'd love if a few other people, came and placed a bid for this.
Do you expect that?
Nope.
Too complicated. I can understand why. But then again, like you say, a lot of people go to Sark and fall in love with the place, as you did, and as probably everyone involved in this deal has. So it could happen to anyone, I suppose. Okay, then. So how, say I'm a Sark curious person. Can I go and buy one of these houses, or can I rent one of these houses, or can I, how do I get involved?
So the incredible thing is that anyone can buy any property on Sark. You, no matter where you're from, whatever citizenship you've got, the more difficult question is, are you allowed to live there? And the short answer is that basically you need to be British or Irish to move there. If you're British or Irish, you can move there tomorrow. All you need is a place to live in. Then you can register as a resident. So that's very easy. Anyone since Brexit until Brexit, anyone with an EU citizenship could move there very freely, which is how I got there. And
that's interesting. Yeah, I forgot about that. So how? So you moved there, and then do you have to get some kind of a special permit to live there now?
No. So basically, anyone who was in the British Isles with an EU citizenship at the time of Brexit was given a temporary permission to remain there until they have stayed for 5 years. And then after 5 years, if you're still there, then you get your permanent residency.
For the UK or for Sark?
Both. It works for all okay. the jurisdictions.
Right.
So I have the so-called settled status. So I'm allowed to be there forever, however long I want. And I can apply for the citizenship, which is a Guernsey issued passport, bailiwick of Guernsey, it's British Isles, it's all sort of...
Really? There's another passport?
Yeah, there is. And depending on who you ask, it's either the same as a British passport or it's slightly different. I believe that if it came to military service, then citizens of Guernsey would be excluded. But it's complicated. Let's maybe stick to the residence. So... anyone who's not British or Irish needs a visa to live in Sark nowadays. And the easiest way is, or the two easiest ways, you can get a job, which of course in Sark is not easy because there's nothing much but the tourism industry, or you can marry someone.
What's the dating scene like?
Limited.
Average age?
Well, I told you about the demographics. So... You could also, in theory, move there either to set up a business and run it there, or because you're an artist. But these entrepreneur visas and artist visas are in reality not very attractive, especially since they haven't been updated in decades. And
these are UK visa things, nothing to do with Sark government.
There's special visas for the Channel Islands, for Guernsey, which also apply to Sark by way of Sark agreed to use them as well. But all of this was set up a long time ago. And in today's world, when a lot of countries are very competitive in terms of attracting new residents, they're not competitive products anymore.
Is there any way that the government of SAARC can create new incentives?
I'd say, again, complicated. It's not something we spend much time worrying about, because that is, as a possibility, it's so far away. And at the same time, I mean, you know, so we make the case, we're absolutely unapologetic to say SAARC needs more people. What the right number is a totally separate subject matter, and that's a public debate and a planning process, etc. But SAARC needs more people. And whatever that number is, given that there are 70 million people with a British or Irish passport who are also perfect fits in the sense they speak the language already, they understand the culture, they can probably find the place on a map, why would we even worry about attracting anyone else? Frankly, it's just when someone emails me who's an EU citizen, I'd say, sorry, you just missed the boat. It's, you know, I'm not even attempting to help you, because there's nothing attractive for you as a visa category. And frankly, you will just always be completely outcompeted in the housing market by all the existing Brits and Irish people who want to move there.
What's the rental market like then?
Difficult right now in the sense that there's not much available. So before I started this campaign to bring new residents to SAARC in 2020-21, which we spoke about in the last podcast, about 20% of the actually available rental stock was empty because no one wanted to live in SAARC at the time. That has now changed to there's a real shortage. I believe there's almost like a waiting list already. There's no official waiting list, but de facto, there's a waiting list of people who want to move there. It's not just the amount of real estate that's available, it's also the quality. Frankly, much of it I just simply wouldn't want to live in myself. And the prices, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Depending on who you ask, people will say, oh, it's really expensive or it's really cheap. It depends on individual circumstances. But to give you an example, basically for £25,000 a year, you get a very nice house with a garden, if you can find one. An apartment, two bedrooms, would probably cost you something like £15,000 a year, maybe £16,000, £17,000, order of magnitude.
So about £2,000 a month for a nice house.
Yeah.
Which is, that's quite a lot compared to where I live, but obviously not compared to London.
It's that you can also occasionally find something for £6,000 or £8,000, and then always keeping in mind that Guernsey is an incredibly wealthy place, and there's also arbitrage going on between these markets in the Channel Islands. So during the pandemic, when Guernsey property went through the roof, people moved from Guernsey to SAARC because it was cheaper there, which then obviously drove up prices in SAARC.
Was there a market, quite a market for buying of houses? I mean, how often do people leave the island and say, that's it, I'm out, or die, or whatever?
So like with any small island and remote island, you have a fair amount of churn. That's inevitable.
Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I lived and worked in the Galapagos Islands for 4 years, which is also very remote, very iconic, very attractive in a way. Attracts a lot of people, but then spits out a lot of them as well. In Galapagos, our rule of thumb was that when we hired someone from outside of the island, I ran the largest employer over there as CEO, 50% of them would not be there anymore after 6 months. And
is that something to do with the dream and the reality?
Yep, absolutely. Right. And it's always, as I always joke, it's always the spouse, you know. Husband wants to get that job or wants to live there. Wife says, yeah, I'll come along. And then after a couple of months, it's just like, honey, I can't do this anymore. lack of facilities, island fever, different lifestyle. It's many factors. In any case, there's a high churn. That just comes with the territory. In terms of buying houses, so SAARC's real estate market is more complex than you would think. And most houses come with some pretty insane issues. Everything is always complicated and never quite as straightforward as people think it is. And I believe, especially in the last couple of months, the houses, or we don't have many sales anymore right now, at least, because a lot of people say this is also bonkers here, and I don't have visibility of the future as well. There are a lot of doubts about the future of the island. I'm just going to rent. And frankly, that's what I did since 2017. I said exactly the same thing. I have no visibility on where this place is going. I love it right now. I'm going to rent. And if I don't like it anymore, I'll hand back the key.
Okay, then. So talk me through and be brutal about this. You know, I phone you up and say, right, I want to move to Sark. You know, I want to live there. I've got a viable way of making a living there. What are the stages? Say I'm a UK citizen, or I shouldn't say, we won't bother with everyone else, but
it's almost insanely easy. So the one piece of advice I would give you is that rent the first place that you come across that seems acceptable to you, because you need to have a toehold on the island. And what people generally do is they rent somewhere, and then once you're on the island, you hear about things coming up. So you get first pickings, and then eventually you sort of upgrade, you move on to the place that you actually really like. And basically, as soon as you've signed a rental contract, you send an email to the government, and they email back, yeah, we've registered you now as a resident. They might ask you for a copy of your rental contract or something like that. And then you need to register for the utilities, which is basically electricity and garbage, and you're done. That's it.
So you don't go to the, you don't have to declare yourself, and let, except when you actually get there and you actually rent the place. There's no, you're, as a UK citizen, you can come and go as you wish. It's just that if you want to stay and live, you need a residence permit. Or you need to inform them of your residence.
You need to inform them, basically.
Yeah, it's not a permit, right?
It's no. Correct. Yeah.
Right.
It's not.
And what about the current situation now for that exact thing? Is it something that you could do right now? You said that, you know, two years ago that was a much easier task.
Well, the issue is housing.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Like, but there's also always something available somewhere. So I'm flying back tomorrow. If you want to move tomorrow, you know, come along. We'll find somewhere for you. And the following day, you're a Sark resident.
Okay, I was going to say that. Where what about, how do people look remotely, or where do they go? Like, it's a big thing for you. It's, you're coming and going. You know, I moved from one side of the UK to the other, and I already knew that place. You know, I would imagine you would probably advise some people, if they want to move to Sark, to come on holiday there first, I would imagine.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. And we've had people in the past who just turned up.
Well, ready to live.
Well, having rented something from afar, and
really
just so, moving in, although that was primarily a matter of the pandemic. There was one guy who moved from Australia and he'd never been before. Nowadays, I mean, people visit first, really. There's a real estate agency firm on the island. I'd say half of the real estate that comes up goes to the real estate agency.
Oh, they're online, I take it.
They're online as well. Yeah, I mean, really, the critical test is, first of all, visiting, but secondly, you haven't really put your roots down in Sark until you have spent two consecutive winters there. It's the winters that really get people. Besides that, there's not much to it, other than you just need to shift your stuff and learn how things work, which is just all slightly different.
And once again, for people that didn't listen to the first podcast we did, how do you get there?
So Sark has no airport, starting point. You need to fly to Guernsey, the neighboring island, which is, I think, 5 miles away, and then take a boat, which is the ferry to Sark, which is government owned and runs a couple of times a day in summer. In winter, it runs less, and sometimes in winter, on some days, it doesn't run at all. Or you can take a private boat, and there are also private charter boats, which you can get. So, in effect, you have to travel through London. There are other options as well, but from London, you've got 5 or 6 flights a day to Guernsey, and then you take a taxi to the harbour and you hop on a boat and you get over to Sark. There are flights in the UK from, I think, Manchester, Bristol, a couple of other cities, where you can fly on Origny, which is the state-owned airline of Guernsey. You fly to Guernsey. From the European mainland, from France, you can take a ferry that I believe only runs in summer and then goes to Jersey or Guernsey first, and then from there you go to Sark. I've never done that, funnily enough. There are some options, but basically you fly from London.
And planning your trip in advance? Because it's the kind of place that, unless you've been before, I take it, you know, what's the best place to go to plan or resource?
So there's a website of Sark Tourism. It's sark.co.uk, and they have all the resources online that you need to plan your visit.
Best place, actually, before I ask you that, give me the timeline that you think or you predict for your plans.
So we're going to make an offer for this real estate in the foreseeable future, and we're then giving it a couple of months to find a deal. If no deal is found, we walk away from this idea, and it's then effectively dead, because these things can't be revived easily. You know, you get your investors to back you, and they trust you on, we will make this work somehow. And if you don't deliver, then basically you've burned your reputation, and the investors move on. And also, frankly, there's a point where I've just spent 3 years of my life on investigating this, and it's been extremely interesting. But am I going to spend the rest of my time, of my life, attempting to do this? You know, no. So in the next couple of months, we will know if this goes anywhere or not. And changing ownership for 180 properties takes a while. So there'll be a certain process towards completion if it happens, if an offer is accepted. But from spring next year onwards, we'd probably be operating all these properties.
But what could stop this deal then?
First of all, the current owners need to accept an offer. It's as simple as that.
Yes.
And I mean, we can, you know, I must look somewhat delusional to go on a podcast to speak about this before we've even made an offer, never mind accepted. But because of this thing being so peculiar, we also have to be very public and very transparent, because otherwise we're going to be accused of being the opposite. And then we go back to the history of the place. As I said, as I always, you know, with my girlfriend, conclude that the baseline expectation is that we'll come to an agreement somehow. So the owners changing their mind and wanting to keep it, or, you know, the price being unrealistic, that's what could stop it. The other, there's a 10% risk that for one reason or another, in the next couple of weeks or the next month or two, we say, you know what, this is too difficult. And I don't know, you know, if we get lots of bad press and, you know, I don't know, people harassing me in the street, etc., which is not going to happen, but, you know, for argument's sake, then, you know, I have other things to do in my life.
Brits aren't the best at supporting things like this, as you well know.
I would disagree with that. So the amount of support I get from all sorts of people, organizations, companies, influential people, stakeholders, is extraordinary, because there's this sense that Sark is stuck and Sark is in danger of ending up in a very bad place where you might not be able to fix it anymore. And it's you can paint a very negative picture, but I also have to say that in few other places would you get support of such kind, plus the investor interest, which helps as well. You know, it helps to, you know, not struggle with funding.
Okay, final question. Best way to keep informed of this deal that you're doing? How do people stay updated, especially people that are thinking about seeing how it fares in order to decide whether this is something that they might want to join in the future?
So we have a very basic, almost embarrassingly basic website for this project, which is called sarkpropertycompany.com. It's a very simple web domain. And on the front page, on the start page, you can register your email address for an email list. And that's how we're going to keep people informed. So don't be put off by how bad the website looks like. We just didn't put any money into it because, as I said, we don't own this stuff yet.
But presumably, if you're someone, if this gets the go-ahead, you're going to be looking for tenants. And is that right?
Absolutely. And there's great value in registering now, because as soon as this goes somewhere, I will start to quite concretely look for, okay, if we have all this stuff, what are we going to do with it on day one? And the sooner I'm in touch with people, the better. People should put themselves on our radar.
Great. Thanks, Sven. Great to hear your update. I'm quite excited for you. I've yet to come, as you know, but I'm almost sure it's an imminent thing. I might wait till this summer, maybe. Let's see.
Summer is obviously the best time to visit, so come in July or August.
Do you have people coming in winter? I mean, is there an I like cold, windy places too, you know.
Some, but very few, and most places shut down in winter. So you wouldn't find restaurants that are open, maybe one. And then January, February, the whole place is just shut.
Really? Okay. Summer it is. All right. Great talking to you, Sven. Good luck with everything you're doing. And hopefully I'll speak to you in 6 months' time. We'll have another update.
Thanks so much. And the next time we'll do it again with the senior as well, who's my partner and collaborator in this. And for sure, we'll have him around next time.
Great.
Thank you.